Okay. Thank you, early risers, for coming to our panel. This panel is about the demographics of casual gaming. And I'm going to let the panelists introduce themselves in just a moment and also show you some. We're going to first have a presentation by Michael Kai with some level setting on statistics around the demographics of casual gaming and gaming in general. And then a couple of the other panelists will show you some of their sites, and we'll see the some of the differences between sites that are largely attractive to females versus males. I'm your host this morning, Sharon Weinbar. I'm a partner at Scale Venture Partners. We invest in game companies. I'm on the board of Glu Mobile, which is the largest independent mobile game company, and we were also a big investor in Aegea, which was recently acquired by NVIDIA. So we kind of had both the small form factor and the really intense core gamer markets covered. So to get started, I'd love to actually have a view first on the audience and your interests. How many folks here are game developers? A handful. And how about publishers thinking about including games in your site? About even? And then who are the others? What's your interest in games? So what? Why don't you just, if anybody wants us to cover something specific. Okay. So why don't I first turn it over to Michael and let Michael give us a good overview, and then we'll introduce the rest of the panelists and get started.
So I introduce myself and then do the interview and the slides. I'm Michael Tai. I'm the director of broadband and gaming at Parks Associates, and we're based in Dallas, and we do market research. Gaming happens to be one of my focus areas. So Sharon asked me to share a few data charts and slides so we know what the female gamers are doing and kind of get some idea in terms of how they are different from the rest of the gaming audience, meaning the male gamers. So here's the typical female gamer. That's my three-year-old, and she's been playing Bubble on my PDA for the past 6 months, and she's getting really good. And right now on my PDA, the high score was actually from her. And clearly, the female gamers, they do favor computers. If you take a look at this data chart, this is actually the average time spent on different platforms among all the internet gamers, meaning gamers who have internet access at home and play on any of those platforms for at least 1 hour per month. And you can clearly see that comparing female to male gamers, female gamers like the computer platforms better. And what was interesting was we divided up those people who said they play different kinds of games on the PC, and we divided them into three different groups. One is the casual only audience, meaning when they play on the computer, they only play the so-called casual genres, including card, puzzle, word, and those kind of games. And if you look at that audience, female gamers actually account for 62% of that audience. And on the other extreme, if you look at the computer core only audience, very, very little percentage goes to the females, not surprisingly.
So, sorry, Michael.
Yes.
Were the raw numbers there, does that mean that the general audience, people who played both, was the
exactly.
Vast, they're 1,460 as opposed to 700? So they're more of the middle bar overall in your survey?
No.
N equals 1460, does that mean the number of respondents who were in that category? Just curious.
Yes.
Okay.
The middle bar is those who, yeah.
So most people play both.
Yeah, exactly. And then what was interesting was the female gamers, they actually play more sessions on the computer than the male gamers on average, except for the 18 to 34. Age group, a lot of them do play with their boyfriends or husband on the console platform as well, so they are lighter on the PC platform. However, if you look at the female 13 to 17, very heavy flash gamers or virtual world or webcams gamers, so they actually log a lot of sessions on the computer, and then the older female gamers as well, they're fairly heavy in terms of using the computer to play gaming sessions. And again, the female and older online PC gamers, they are much more likely to spend a lot of time on the computer platform as well. A lot of the retired folks, they really don't have a lot of entertainment activities. So the quite a large percentage of them actually go online and play casual games if you look at the female 55 and older demographics. And in terms of the top genres they play, again, this is the entire internet gamer universe. This is not the, the so-called console gamer demographics. So even for the males, you see the puzzle and card games are actually fairly popular. But if you look at the female and the female, the male gamers, it's quite clear females, they pretty much just play those kind of games, nothing else. And then the male gamers, if you look at the 13 to 17 year olds, the favorite genres are actually the action, adventure, first person shooter, and driving games. And for the other male demographics, you can actually see at least first person shooter games will show up on the top three genres they play. So based on our research, it's actually interesting, even those so-called power or hardcore console gamers, the male gamers, they also play a lot of casual games as well when they don't have the console with them, when they only have access to a PC or a portable device, they will also play some of those casual games as well. And in terms of online gaming genres, again, puzzle and card games, they are much more popular among the females when they go online. Most of them just go to Pogo, Play First, or some of the other sites to find those games to play. And then first-person shooter genre, in terms of online connected sessions, the majority of the audience there is really male gamers. Again, not all that surprising. That's all I have to share, and obviously we're going to entertain some questions during the session.
Cool. Sure. Hi, my name is John Welch, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Play First, or the leading publisher focused exclusively on casual gaming, which means we focus mostly on the female side of the audience. Just to give you a little bit of info on that, about 70% of our consumers are female. And in our most famous game, Diner Dash, which I'm going to show you, 90% of our purchasers are female. But we still get quite a lot of, you know, with a mass market type of entertainment, we do see males and females in large numbers of both. But typically, when we think of casual games from our perspective, we're thinking about females. What I thought I'd do is pretty quickly show you what the model is when I talk about casual games, especially with respect to monetization today. Heavily based today and looking backwards on this download, try before you buy model, which I'm about to show you. I just went to a website, which looked something like this, and downloaded a game, and I get this screen, it says play, and I get a half hour or an hour free trial. At the end of that, it times out and says you need to pay $20. That's a model I launched back in 2001, one of the first games to do so, and in fact, it's a model that we're trying to largely supplant with new models, like games are free and you pay for items for your avatar, or you pay small amounts of money for online content, or they're monetized with ads or subscription. So here you see our latest game, Diner Dash Hometown Hero. This is actually online content, web pages, but in a full screen download type of beautiful experience. And just give you a quick, idea. This is, how many people here have heard of Diner Dash or played it? Cool, wow, almost everyone. So maybe I don't need to do this. But so maybe what you need to know is that the latest version, you can actually download items for your avatar, play multiplayer, have episodic content that comes out every month. It's an ongoing, continuous experience with the game. And
you can play as a man.
And you can play as a man or a woman. Yeah, we actually do allow men to play this game as well. So maybe I'll just actually, in the interest of time, let move to the next panelist, since a lot of people are familiar with Diner Dash anyway. Oh yes, and Glue Mobile did an amazing job, and Diner Dash was like the number 6 game of the year last year on Verizon, the game of the year on AT&T Singular for casual. Yeah.
Okay, while we're checking for new items. My name's Jane Pinkard. I've worked in editorial for a long time covering games of all kinds. And I currently work as a business development analyst for a company called Foundation 9, which owns 12 studios across the world that develop all kinds of different games.
So, Jane, are the Foundation 9 games PC games or console games, and are they targeted men or women?
They are PC and console games, and they're targeted largely at men, but they're definitely looking at acquiring studios that have experience in casual because, you know, it's an exciting space.
Okay, good. Okay, Jim?
Windows Vista.
Yes, I'm now. I'd like to show you Congregate on a web page, and it makes me very glad that I don't have to deal with downloads and installs and full screen and Windows in general. So my background, I'm currently the co-founder and CEO of Congregate, which is, you could call it casual games, but since casual games has come to mean what John is talking about, we call it indie web games. So these are, our model is that users upload Flash games. So we've had about around 1,500 people upload games. We've got about 3,500 games, and have about 2.3 million people a month coming to play them. So while our site is sort of YouTube for games, it's very heavily on the player end rather than the developer end. We sort of add a bunch of community around the games, achievements. For those of you who played Xbox Live, we have achievements, collectibles, and a sort of collectible card game that we're going to release in a couple months. So our long-term plan is share advertising revenue with developers. Starting this summer, it'll be give them a microtransaction wallet that they can use to charge for virtual items in their games. So here's one of our games. So you can see it has chat on the right. You can click on anybody's name and see their collection of badges and so forth. This game has a pretty long, actually, intro, so we won't go through it, but it's like a retro space shooter type of thing. The number one game on our site is Desktop Tower Defense, which I don't know if any of you have played it. It's very easy to pick up, but very engrossing strategy game.
Engrossing or maddening.
Right, and freelance journalists are some of our best customers, so ex-freelance journalists. And great. Congregate, by the way, is about 85% male among registered users. We'd like to get that more balanced, but it's pretty boyish right now.
Thank you. So I think one of the key things that you're going to hear from the panel today is that gaming has become a very diverse environment. So, I mean, all of, you know, and it may be that our parents think of gamers as those, you know, teenage guys with no life, with the pizza boxes stacking up, you know, playing on the Xbox. But the activity of gaming is really pervasive across virtually all demographics at this point, although I'm not sure that retired men do games as much as retired women. But, you know, you saw the spectrum from Michael's 3-year-old playing Bubble to I've got 10 and 13-year-old girls who play web-based casual virtual worlds all the time and even abandon The Sims for the web-based games because of their greater connectivity. And then yesterday I was in a shop here in Austin and chatting with the girl helping me at the checkout counter about this panel. And she said, oh, I love games. This is kind of like, you know, really female clothing store. And I said, really, what game do you play? She's like, Lara Croft, you know? And she's like, I play it all the time. And I said, great, do you play web-based games at all? No, I hate those things. And I said, do you play mobile? She's like, oh, I love retro games. I play all the retro games on my handset. So, you know, we just have this very wide diversity of what kind of games people are playing and who's playing them. And that's what we're looking to cover today. But when the panel was thinking about, had a conference call to start off this thinking about the content for the session, one of the things we thought we would cover is actually the demographics of who's making the games, because I think you have a lot of people making games who are hypothesizing about what their players are going to be like. So I was going to ask the three publishers in the room here to talk about the folks in their companies or in their communities making the games and what do we see there, and is there any pending diversity in that, or are we really talking about, you know, guy coders with the pizza boxes?
Okay, so I can take a first crack at that. Actually, I calculated the percentage of Play First production employees, people who make our games, that are female, and it was 26% are female, which is probably about 3x what the industry average is, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, 0% of our actual coders are female.
But producers, designers, I mean, from the perspective of who's controlling the user experience, actually, it's even higher. Because there's 0% coders, that means there's actually an even higher percentage of the designers and producers.
How about you, Jen? What about at Foundation 9?
Oh, my God.
Are there any other women working there?
Walking down the hallway.
Yeah,
that's a plus. No, it's yeah, it's 90% male. I mean, the women that we do have tend to be in fields like artists. You know, mm-hmm. we have some artists, UI designers, but yeah, coders, game designers, they're mostly male. And I think that's also the case at other places, like Three Rings is also very, you know, male driven. They have some female staff, but yeah.
Yeah, so I worked at Pogo previous to this, and Pogo's audience is 60, 70% women, and the development staff was 1.0% women. Basically, there were women in marketing and testing, but basically all the programmers were men. All the producers, in fact, were men as well. Congregate, I co-founded with my sister, who is a casual gamer, and actually she ended up running all of product. So she's, you know, doing.
So she knows what girls want.
She's not really. I think the sort of prototypical player that we have in mind is like, you know, a male high school or college student. But I mean, we've tried to design the site and the branding in a way that's kind of, you know, has broad appeal. But there's no doubt. I mean, and then the people making the games on our site. I looked in the database, so there's. Out of the, I think it was when I looked, it was like 1,400 developers. There were about 10 who claimed to be female, but if you looked at their profiles, they clearly were just screwing around. They also claimed to be like 100 years old. So there's one actual female who's actually uploaded a game, and it was a Tetris game with cats in it. So it's a good game, though. She's Italian. So I hope for more, but right now, definitely the sort of, you know, our developers are high school and college kids as well. They're very similar to our players. The Desktop Tower Defense guy is a little older. He's like 26 or something, but it's sort of a young male scene for making games for the most part.
So we've seen all these stats that females are really involved with gaming. What do you think it takes to get women involved with anything that's user-generated? Because this is one of the big buzzwords in casual gaming. And in my experience is in some of the classic casual sites, things like Big Fish, where there are a lot of classic games like Mahjong and card games that the women are involved in personalizing the games and skinning the tiles and things like that. Is that a growing trend, or is that just a little dead end alley?
Well, I think one of the most prolific forms of user generated content on the web today is simply forums and people typing into websites in one form or another. And we find that women are certainly more active on playfirst.com on our forums, extremely active in that Diner Dash game where you can customize your avatar and that sort of thing. Again, that it's when we find what items are most successful in our avatars and who's buying them, it's when people can express themselves in something really creative. We just launched a caveman cafe and you can get like a bone to go through your hair now as a kind of a hat. It's very creative type of thing, and that is largely women, and many times we're finding women for the first time doing these sorts of activities on our website.
I think social networking is definitely a new channel for that. I mean, we have three people in our office, all female. They play Scrabulous on Facebook. I mean, yeah, although they are involved in a lawsuit, but I mean, they help redistribute the game in a certain way. But
that's not really user-generated content, though. That's just,
no, it's not generated.
I think it's about making. I mean, there aren't really standardized tools for creating games, for example, really easily. And I think there are people working on that, though. And I think, and I've seen some like indie, you know, developed tools that make it a lot easier to just, you know, create your own games. And I think that could help. I also think, you know, things like customizing avatars, not just buying items for your characters or for your, you know, space, but also, you know, in arenas like Second Life, for example, there are some women who go to great lengths to build, you know, their own galleries, and then they fill it with art that they've created or their friends create or things like that. So it's about, I think, providing both a space and a place to be able to do that and also the tools that people can, you know, figure out.
Right, I think that's definitely true. The sites that allow community-generated content, so especially the item payment model, but where the catalog of items is produced by the community, not just injected by the publisher. In general, you often have a lot of women involved in making that content because it's not, there's a relatively fixed format for doing that. But making the customized t-shirts or wings or whatever you want, it is to enhance your avatar. So sites like Second Life, as you said, or ImView, which is not strictly speaking a game, it's kind of a bridge in between an instant messaging environment, a virtual world that has some gameplay in it. But the community there that contributes the content, it's all community-generated content that is for sale, and you have quite a number of women there making quite substantial revenue. I mean, they're running businesses making that content. Mm-hmm. And I think you find that in other socially generated or community-generated commerce sites, even things like Cafe Press, you have a lot of women contributing that kind of content too. So I think as the games become more community-based and it's not just purely gameplay that's being contributed as on Kongregate, but other items around that, you might find a broader swath of the community participating in that. So before we switch to, we were going to switch from the demographics of publishers to the demographics of gameplay and some of the issues around monetization. I just want to turn it to the audience in this section about publishers. Any questions about who's building these things? Nope. Okay. Not had caffeine yet.
Who's not building them? It's such a hot space right now.
I know.
Yes, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting yet another casual game company or yet another casual MMO target.
Which, just to put that in perspective, is like so amazing to me because I remember going to the Game Developers Conference over the past 10 years, and even up to like 4 years ago, people would look at casual game-focused companies as, why are you at my conference? And I really think we're kind of at this turning point now of, at some point we see in front of us it's going to be core gaming is going to become a niche part of the industry. And when casual gaming finally really achieves its true promise, we'll stop talking about casual gaming because gaming will just be something that everybody does. And we're not quite there yet. And we're seeing little proof points with things like Wii Sports and Diner Dash and what have you that really broaden gaming. But at some point, gaming will truly become a first-tier form of entertainment along with watching television and reading books and magazines. And we're just starting to see, I think today, an explosion of the kinds of diversity of content that's necessary in order to find out what's going to work for different segments of the population.
Right, well, just to put it in perspective, order of magnitude revenue in these different segments, you've got, you know, core PC and console game being order of magnitude, $10 billion a year business, casual games probably being about $1 billion a year in business, you know, mobile games being maybe $500-700 million in revenue. So, you know, that there is a lot more revenue generated by the things that sell for $50 on a CD than the things that sell for $20 download or are monetized by advertising yet, but it is definitely broadening the base.
But if you separate out PC retail software, I mean, that's less than $1 billion now. Actually, casual PC gaming is already a larger market than the retail part.
The true opportunity we're looking at here, just to why we're so excited, certainly from a financial perspective, is more people have played Diner Dash than have played Halo or The Sims. Now, there's more economic value that's been created by orders of magnitude with Halo or The Sims. And so, but when you look at the opportunity, there it is.
Discussing that on the way in, what, you know, and along with a couple of other topics. So we will get there. Thank you.
Well, I just to jump in for a second, I don't think that's an issue when you're working on a team necessarily, because you're working on a team. But if somebody wanted to make a game and put it up on Kongregate, If a woman didn't know really her way around action scripting or code at all, you know, what does she do? She has to find a friend to program it for her. So I think there you start seeing that become a problem.
That $20 download category, why it's, I think, a real sweet spot. One reason is because women actually have such a more powerful role there. Because even though they're not the coders, when you're the producer or the designer, you're kind of the boss, especially when a team is so small where there's only one coder, maybe two coders, but there's a producer and a designer, and one of those is very likely to be female, if not both, at our company. And so they have a very strong voice. And also keep in mind that when you're talking about the you know, we're kind of in this midpoint also between small games, maybe on Jim's site that one person created or two people, small, very small budgets, and the astronomically big console budgets of $10 or $15 million or what have you. But even at our level of $200,000 to $400,000 to create a game, we're doing significant amounts of market testing, from user panels coming in one at a time to focus groups to beta tests that have between 600 and 1,000 users in them. And our audience being 70% female, when we're looking at what the audience is telling us, we're asking 70% females what we should be doing.
I think another thing that changes this is the rise of actual good gaming education programs. Kim Swift, who's the creator of Portal, I don't know whether she can program or not, but she went to a school where she was able to hook up and sort of work for years in a creative way and came up with something amazing. So hopefully
Kelly
that'll
Santiago,
continue.
Yeah. Made Flow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like definitely the just for whether cultural or whatever reasons, you know, the average, it's more likely for a 12-year-old boy to just start hacking on his computer. And I think having things in sort of, you know, a more school-like setting for some females is more approachable.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have a 13-year-old daughter who's in middle school, and they have as their kind of advanced science class for an after-school program is game development. And she's been doing game development for the last couple of years after school. But I do think there is a social problem when the women don't get the high-paid engineering jobs and the women get the low-paid graphic design jobs. That's a wholly different
issue. But let's look at the output of our computer science programs and then talk about what the inputs of the computer science programs are. I think that the problem does rest much earlier. We try very hard to hire competent female.
Right. Yes. No, I wasn't trying to rag on you. But it's also funny, just speaking as an investor, and I see lots and lots of business plans for emerging game companies. And it always seems ironic to me that some guy, founder, will come and say, I have, you know, the new thing that women are going to want to do. And it's going to involve, and we'll get into this in a second, gameplay, and it'll be this new different form of gameplay that will be really attractive to women. And I said, that's really interesting. How do you know this is going to be really attractive to women? And they go, well, women want this. Women are different than them. I'm like, okay, and how do you know? And, well, my wife likes this. And you know, that is not as statistically saying, you know, especially when it's your wife in Hillsborough, California, is not a statistically sound way of developing a new business. Although a lot of innovation does come just from having that different vision. So let's turn it to kind of the differences in gameplay of games that are attractive to girls, women, boys, men. Are there different forms of gameplay that are attractive? For example, I'm thinking of one site in particular where the entrepreneurs, you know, has a vision that women do not want to compete. They want to collaborate, and they want to gang together to advance the collective score, and it's not at all about individual points, you know, which is kind of the far end of the spectrum from let me beat the ogre and get the most gold. So kind of let's talk about that, the different forms of gameplay and what's attractive to whom, and do, for example, with casual games, do men play them differently than women play them or for a different reason?
Wow, there's a lot of topics in there.
Yeah, well, guys,
I'll take one angle and let some other folks give their ideas. I think one of the things that we look at very closely at PlayFirst is the theme of the game. We're always thinking about what can be accessible. You can't get someone to buy something unless they played it. You can't get them to play it if they look at it and it's just not attractive to them. So what's not attractive or accessible to large amounts of the female market? Explosions, men in tights swinging swords, casting fireballs, orcs, hobgoblins, blood, big boobs, and violence, and that sort of thing. We women tend to be more attracted to everyday types of themes. They tend to be, like, to see the female body not portrayed in unlikely scenarios and unlikely ways.
Except
they don't.
Barbie, yeah.
They like it accessorized and clothed, not the opposite extreme. Right. So there's always exceptions. Certainly, there are females who can absolutely crush me at any first-person shooter or World of Warcraft or any kind of thing like that, right? But my wife, who I apologize for the crying baby that is mine, she can destroy me at Diner Dash. I can't even come close to playing Diner Dash with her. And I can honestly tell you that she would not be interested in playing a World of Warcraft or whatever. And it's got nothing to do with the gameplay. She wouldn't even have the opportunity to assess the gameplay because it's got to be attractive for her to even want to get in and try the experience.
So, Michael, what?
No, because actually my statements are not based on what one person says, but rather a lot of, like, 10 years of experience looking at databases, doing market research, that sort of thing. So, yes. Yeah. Oh, no problem at all. And so, you know, it's funny that, you know, the kinds of themes, to give you some concrete examples of what I'm talking about. So Diner Dash is a very kind of everyday type of theme. It's a diner, and it's something you can have a lot of fun with. The theme doesn't get in the way. The theme enables creativity. Other themes that we've used, Wedding Dash. Chocolatier is a game about finding ingredients to make chocolates and sell chocolates. It's actually a very complex economic simulation game, but it's put underneath a theme that's accessible and interesting. There are complex economic simulation games that you would not want to play. Large numbers of people would not want to play or be attracted to. And then Dream Chronicles is another one of our big games, and it is more of a fantasy game, but again, it has an approachable theme, an approachable story.
Michael, what does the research say on how women play games versus men, or in the same kind of game, what do they do differently?
Well, we do both focus groups and surveys. So like you said, and like that lady said, you do have women out there who play those kind of games. I mean, we actually had a 50-year-old in one of the focus groups who played Grand Theft Auto. And we've got a 20-year-old and his grandma plays like Call of Duty 4, and who's like 70 years old.
That's a good game.
But you do just have, that's a very small percentage, but most of the women, they do tend to play just to unwind, and the common thing we hear from them is, when I play, I don't want to create more stress, I want to relieve stress. I mean, if you ask me to play those kind of games, it's going to be really stressful to use the controller and all that. But on the other hand, I mean, Guitar Hero and Rock Band, those two games are bringing in so many new gamers into the industry. And a lot of them go to their friend's house or saw the game at a party, and now they're more interested in the console platform just because of that. And in terms of competition, one thing that came out was, yeah, females are less interested in competing against others. They do want to compete against themselves. So they do care about scores and those kind of things, but leaderboard is a little bit less important to them compared to the male console gamers.
Jim, you've been at both Pogo and now you've got Congregate, and Pogo is, I think, majority women, mm-hmm. and Congregate majority men, but yeah, a lot of the kind of social features are the same.
Yeah.
So can you comment on this?
So first, I can kind of at least have one anecdote that kind of confirms the cooperative story. So on Pogo, there is a bingo game, and there became a problem because a lot of people would play in a room together. So you'd have like 40 people playing bingo, and they would want to wait until everybody had bingo and then all call it together and share the points, which is nice. But then you would get people who came into that room and didn't know that was the rules, and they would call bingo when they got it, and then everybody else in the room would yell at them. So we had like a sort of customer service, like, what do you do? So we ended up creating separate cooperative bingo rooms. But those are bingo players. So there's a lot, I mean, for instance, you know, there's a lot of Diner Dash. Like, Diner Dash is great, but the overall effect on it, I think, is a little nauseating. So when my sister saw Carrie the Caregiver as a Diner Dash knockoff, she really wanted to vomit. There's a lot of that, and I think it's a little overdone. Diner Dash is a great franchise, however. So in terms of the social features, I think what really, you know, so when Club Pogo, when I started at Pogo, it was just a free service that was losing money. And we launched Club Pogo, which is a subscription service, and there was a big list of features that it was going to be about. And the one that really succeeded is something that will be familiar to Xbox Live players. It was actually on Pogo first, but it's called achievements or badges. They're called on Pogo. So you win a game, you get a little postage stamp sized piece of art that goes in your profile. A smaller version goes next to your, you know, name in chat. So it's a very visible way of showing off your progress. So I think, and that was incredibly popular. I mean, I think, you know, basically the sort of takeaway from that is, you know, 45-year-old women who play bingo or solitaire or word games want to sort of level up and, you know, ride an elite mount and all these concepts that, you know, are more familiar from male games. So we sort of, the genesis of Kongregate was looking at that pattern and saying, well, you know, this doesn't exist for indie Flash games. Like, you know, I like playing, you know, all these little Flash games made by, like, you know, the independent community, but the sites that house them, Addicting Games, Miniclip, aren't really adding much. I think the thing is those community features are pretty universal. Like most gamers who want to play games want to save their progress, want their friends to see it. You know?
Let me ask. So on Pogo or other sites like that that are more female oriented, are the women playing in general with people they know in the real world? And contrast that with other sites. So, and it was funny. So at one point we were doing due diligence on one of these big sites that has a lot of women on it and community features. And my young male associate attempted to enter many different game rooms to play and was rebuffed by the women in the room and said, you know, no, we're here. We don't want to play with a stranger. Get out. You know, and I kept saying, Garth, you've got to tell them that you're like a very handsome 28-year-old. Maybe they'll let you in. But the game rooms were really socializing with people they knew in the real world and coming together online. So is that common? And is that is there a different willingness to play with strangers versus for men versus women?
I'm wondering if those people actually knew each other in the real world or just have got to know each other within the community. Yeah. I know the one bizarre thing. So before I founded Play First 4 years ago, I ran the games business at Shockwave.com, which was one of the original casual gaming sites in the net. And we had a game called Inklink, which is still up on the site today. It's a great game. It's an 8-way multiplayer game, kind of Pictionary-like game. And in this game, which was, in fact, I got to know the community pretty well because the technology was pretty bad and the servers would need to be rebooted at random times. And in fact, you know, my entire staff, we all knew how to log in and reboot the servers. And some of the people in the community got our direct email addresses and would, you know, would ping us when that needed to happen. Occasionally, it's embarrassing to say, this is many years ago at a different company. But one thing in particular that happened is that they wrote to us in advance one day. They said in mid-December, and they said, we're going to be having a big New Year's Eve. We're celebrating New Year's Eve on Inklink, the community. And it turns out I got to know some of these people online. I don't know them in the real world. And they were from middle America. And they were people who didn't know each other in the real world. Because I started asking questions back and forth, get to know the people. And it turns out it's just people who met each other in the Inklink community and they like to spend time with each other to the extent that they were spending their New Year's Eve together and they wanted to make sure those servers were going to be up.
Is that something we should be celebrating?
Yeah.
Or is it pathetic?
Well, you don't drink and drive, I guess, if you're doing
that. Yeah, it's better than with the alternative being.
I think for Pogo, a lot of people were referred by friends in the real world. Pogo marketing, I think it's better now, but historically Pogo has not done a very good job of marketing. It's all been word of mouth. So people sort of, they come into it, you know, with a friend, but I think very quickly most of their friendships on the service are online only. And there's been some very dramatic, there was a murder that actually happened. There's a big story. This was like last year. It's a long story. A guy who pretended to be a young Marine and like established this whole like romantic relationship and then killed his rival in that romantic relationship.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was so let's talk about that for a little bit because this
murder.
And I think it goes to a lot of the virtual worlds and casual virtual worlds. So, and again, just to launch into this, I'll say because our kids play all these web-based games and our 13-year-old daughter was very heavy on Neopets and Millsbury, so classic, really safe kids casual game sites, and then graduated to playing on RuneScape. And in RuneScape, you can communicate with other people you don't know. So it's a casual virtual world, all web-based. And she had a couple of friends who played actively and brought her into the game. And so she started playing actively. And I would sit down and watch her play. And the thing was, boys, I don't know if they're really boys, but other characters would come up to her within 5 minutes of logging in and ask her to kiss them. And it always turned her off. You know, here's this girl just, you know, straddling the, you know, I sleep with my stuffed animal, yet I, you know, I spend my day thinking about Juicy Couture. So kind of right on that edge, you know, tween is very a tweener world. And she was always being approached by guys, and it really freaked her out, and she stopped playing. And now she's very involved with Webkinz, which is kind of, you know, really targeted at the three-year-old. But when I ask her what she likes about that, she likes the fact that it's a very controlled environment. You can only send messages to people you know, and you can only send messages from a pre-approved checklist right. of canned strings, so you can't even type into it. So there's no chance that someone's going to come on to you in an untoward way. So, and after all of this, I was having a discussion with there's a new CEO of RuneScape, and I related the story to him, and they implemented a new feature that you can select out of being talked to by people you don't know. So you can now toggle to where the only people who can chat with you are people who you've put on your pre-approved list, which still hasn't brought Sophia back into the world. But let's talk a little bit about that. The casual virtual games, men, women, teen girls and boys on those, and what are they doing? You know, are the boys just out there cruising? Or are they playing these games? Which kind of games are the girls playing?
Well, I mean, I think you know, social experimentation online is a form of playing for people.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I mean, tons of boys, like half the female avatars in virtual spaces are actually played by men, right? Like, there's actually like 50. They've measured this where it's populations on virtual worlds tend to be 50-50 male-female avatars, but the player base is like 10% female. So I think, you know, that's just sort of a natural sort of experimentation thing that happens in online spaces, not just in games, but on message boards, forums, chat rooms, things like that. And I mean, obviously, you know, kids should be protected or be aware of what's going to happen. But I think for a lot of people, that's a huge part of the appeal.
I think it depends on the world. I mean, Webkinz is really female-driven. Actually, a lot of the... It's really not targeting the three-year-old. I think it's more like the 6 to 8, maybe, and then their moms actually play. I've heard so many stories. Their moms became heavily involved. Originally, it was just trying to help their kids level up.
Parents power-leveling their kids'
yeah.
characters.
Well, and then they got That's so cheating. Involved into it. And then I talked to a woman who wakes up like 3 o'clock in the morning every day to see what kind of rare item is on sale for that day. So it really depends on the world. Some of the other worlds like Habbo or Club Penguin, yeah, you do have more male than female. And not than female, but than Webkinz.
So that brings up actually a question that I have, which is that is not casual behavior. So where is, you know, so to me when you say casual game, that like we were talking about, oh, you have like short play sessions but waking up at 3 a.m. to check for,
right.
That is not casual gaming behavior.
Well, we have seen the emergence of a new sector of yeah. players here where I would say back, you know, 8 years ago, 5 years ago, casual had a much more narrow definition, a much more narrow demographic, and a much more narrow description of play patterns. And now we're seeing that there's actually a substantial sector of our audience, and call it maybe 20-25%, that actually profiles just like male core gamers in terms of hours spent, time shifting later in the night, the amount of time playing in a session is growing longer, it's being sought out, not just a distraction here and there. And I think that's as the art form emerges, and as gaming kind of elevates and becomes this first tier form of entertainment, you're going to find that it's no longer, you know, you can't say, well, you know, guys spend more time. I mean, you probably can. I mean, someone must watch TV more than the other, one half than the other. But I mean, it's much more close. And I think the same thing will happen in gaming. It's just what they're doing gaming will be divergent.
Right. I think that some of the early Parks research and then IDC research mm-hmm. on casual games was very much, I think there was a report titled a couple of years ago that casual doesn't mean yeah. not intense. It just, it's become more of a form factor of game or a delivery mechanism. Yeah. There's a question in the audience.
Well,
mom has the credit card, so I don't think anybody's ever going to discourage them.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that one thing you learn in to be a successful online community, to be a successful online anything, it's not so much about what you want as what your audience wants to do. And so when you get a sizable audience, you need to be really in tune with how they play the product and enable them to be creative in the ways they want. And of course, then be next generational in terms of the really cool stuff you're inventing. You can't ask your audience to invent your next generation, but you certainly can optimize your experience based on how they want to experience. You know, I think that you have to acknowledge, first of all, that ideally, and hopefully, and I'm going to share some of my personal strong beliefs here as a new parent, if you're making a product targeted at kids, you have to acknowledge that the parents are there. They should be there. And so I think it isn't strange necessarily that the parent wants to log in and be part of that experience. Certainly, what was kind of funny in the story I heard recently of a friend of a friend is that one mom was online playing the child's avatar and started chatting. Noticed the friend was also online. Strange, late at night. Started chatting with the friend. One of the two started it, and it turns out they're both the moms.
The moms.
And so I think that what you can kind of imagine is it almost becomes like, you know, my wife takes our child, they have the mother's group or the play dates and things like that. It's not just about the kids playing together. It's also the parents there being social. So, you know, perhaps it's an emergent form of entertainment to be able to say, how are you actually dual enabling the experience both for the child and the parent?
So we're going to switch in just a second to talking about monetization, but let's cover the question about distribution before we segue into a whole new topic. How are these games being discovered? How are they getting into the hands of people? Are there dominant forms of distribution, or now with this huge diversity of gameplay and demographics, is it really kind of open field?
See, one thing I've been kind of struggling with the casual industry was you have all these great companies and great portals, but a lot of the gamers, when they try to find a game, they don't necessarily remember where they went to buy the game or to play the game. They Google it, and then you come up with a big list of portals. You just click on the first one, and then the next time it might be a different one. So I think that's an issue the industry got to kind of address through community features or other kind of features that can keep pulling the same audience back to your own site instead of driving them to Google.
Yeah. Well, that's what we try to do. And we don't do, you know, the question of distribution and monetization are actually linked. So the business model that Shockwave.com and a bunch of other, there are a bunch of web game sites in sort of, you know, bubble 1.0, they were advertising driven. And had a broad audience. The ads went away in 2001, and so most of those companies went away. The ones that survived started doing basically the shareware model, downloadable games, which is what John's company historically has done. And they started off with having a broad selection of games, action games, retro arcade games, and all of them would get a lot of downloads and play. The ones that got bought were the ones appealing to that older female gamer, the mom with a credit card, who's more willing to find an experience they like, stick with it, and pay for it. So that's sort of, that business model defined the casual game industry, and it's basically because of that purchasing behavior that older women have. So now that these things are opening up to, you know, both microtransactions as a business model and advertising, that now hopefully it'll be a less, you know, casual games will not mean, you know, such a narrow part of the demographics, and so that's what we're part of. Basically.
But are there other new channels that are opening up that are bringing men into the casual game environment? For example, Xbox Live.
Absolutely.
Arcade.
Xbox Live Arcade.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think even just starting from the internet alone, if you look back in 2001, there was Shockwave and Reel. Then a year or so later, there was MSN and Yahoo that came in, and then AOL doing these download, try before you buy, shareware types of games. Today, there are thousands of websites selling those games. And so why would you go to any one website? As Sharon said, you kind of go to Google, type it in, and you find it. And that's one of the major problems, is that these portals, they want to hold their relationship exclusively with the user, but they're not really doing anything to earn it. And now there's a lot of fragmentation and competition. So you have sites like Jim's who are adding value around the content experience. And I'd say a lot of where we're going with our business is pretty much the same thing. And Jim mentioned Epic Mounts. And I think that's a really intuitive, a really, really, really important point here, is that when you think about one of the most successful online game subscription services ever, World of Warcraft, you don't often overhear people talking about this, you know, casting a specific spell or swinging the sword and chopping the head off of the orc or the hobgoblin. what you hear them talking about is, I finally got my epic flying mount. Or you hear them saying, let's get together and I'll take you through that dungeon and we'll get you that item and we'll get you that flying mount. We'll level you up.
Yeah.
So now there's this new role of even mentoring within the game. But it's about that meta structure. It's about the experience. What are you left with after you've played? You're left with that the avatars and the items and the leveling up of your experience. And that's something that has never really been a part of casual gaming. That's a big focus of us. And I think bringing it back to your question, Sharon, is it absolutely you're going to see as people bring that meta structure around the game experiences and find new places to put that, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's on websites. And Xbox Live has done a tremendously good job of doing that on the console. It actually, I think, redefines, and it's actually the bigger opportunity than, I think we've kind of, gaming, we're there with the gaming. The gaming's good for casual gaming. The next thing that's really bad that we need to get up is this meta structure.
Right. One. So in turning to monetization, and Jim made the observation that monetization and distribution are inextricably linked. And a large part of that is because you want to, if you're not going to do a hit and run, ask for $20, have a 1% success rate, extracting the $20 from a customer and then, you know, not caring, which I don't mean that particularly, about whether they go or not. But if you're monetizing by item payment or you're monetizing by advertising, the end user has to be at your site interacting with your content in order for you to make that money. And so a number of the casual games portals have switched from or are experimenting with dropping, asking people for $20 to pay to download the game and instead converting that to an advertising base, because with a 1% conversion rate, you're getting 20 cents a game. If you can get decent CPMs, that's the price per thousand for advertising, and a relatively decent number of sessions or impressions, you can actually make that 20 cents pretty easily by not asking the person to pay for the game, but instead asking them to sit through a handful of advertisements, whether they're at the beginning of the game, during the interstitials or level changes, or at the end of the game, or in the frame around it. So there's a switch from that download model to the advertising model, and then again, this whole new business model that has been prevalent in Asia and Europe that's really coming to the U.S. in casual games of item payment, and that's asking people to pay real money for virtual items in the game, whether they're items that enhance your gameplay and give you greater powers, or just enhance your status because they're items of rarity and only people who were either in the game at a certain time could have them. As you said, the logging on at 3 o'clock in the morning to see what that new limited item is for the day, or you had to earn them, and only people with a certain ability can get them. So let's talk about monetization, where that's going, how that's affected by the demographics. Jane, or you go ahead.
Based on the numbers we are seeing, I mean, out of the $1 billion or so revenue generated in the U.S. from casual gaming in 2007. The majority still came from, number one, web-based advertising, the traditional model, not in-game advertising, and then number two, the download-to-own model, the 1% conversion Sharon mentioned earlier. So those combined are still like 75%+ of the market. But in terms of the emerging business models, definitely the companies in the industry have kind of passed the early experimental stage for in-game advertising. I mean, you have Real Network and a few other companies, including PlayFirst, really pushing hard to do more in-game advertising to monetize either that one-hour demo or the entire game available for free and try to get the CPM dollars. And then the item sales model, it's kind of emerging as well in the U.S., as you mentioned. I think EA already announced, what, $18 million in revenue from the Pogo Jams?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, in 2007. But for that, we need to see how sustainable it is, because, I mean, we have seen some consumers kind of calling that model a little cheesy and where's the stop? I mean, what if I end up with $1,000 on my credit card bill or something? And so the companies in the space need to kind of ease off those concerns and make sure either you implement a cap or something like that so they don't spend $1,000 and never come back.
Right.
So
I'm going to take some notes here, if that's okay, Michael.
The early days of mobile content when, especially on people with teenagers on family plans, ended up delivering mom a very expensive cell phone for a lot of bills, a lot of ringtones. We've got a question here. Oh, the question is about CPMs and advertising.
What happened to Google is actually they got more aggressive about fighting click fraud. So they're getting they're counting fewer clicks, but probably they're getting just as many actual real human clicks. So that was a little overstated by ComScore. Overall, you know, the sort of industry standard thing to quote is that the amount of time spent online has increased much, much faster and is still increasing faster than the amount of advertising dollars spent online. So that has to balance out eventually. Whether, you know, how much the game industry gets of it is still an open question, but obviously we're bullish on it.
So we have numerous investments in different advertising networks and look at a lot of, and you have to think about the ads that are in games or in games, in worlds, or in the frames around games are very different from Google keyword ads. And they're visual ads. They're much more likely to be branding ads than direct response ads. Mm-hmm. And those tend to have a much higher CPM in general. So you can think of a typical maybe $8 to $10, something like that. And there's the opportunity in games and in the world, in the advertising venues related to games, to have a pretty high degree of personalization and targeting because, in general, the customer is registered. So you have potentially access to more information that can allow the advertiser to speak to a more targeted audience, which in general has much higher CPMs. Now, I think the overall reach is not big enough yet in casual games to allow targeting to happen. So because advertisers want to buy in bulk first and then targeting second, so you have to have a lot of people then start segmenting them, and that really hasn't happened yet. But it will likely, and especially when you have sites that have a relatively concentrated demographic. If you have a site that is, you know, say like AOL Games, generally older females, the advertisers can reach those. And that's one of the reasons why so much revenue comes from those sites, is because they have reach, they have targeting, and they're attractive to advertisers because it's also brand-friendly content.
It's interesting, Sharon. That's, you know, how we were observing earlier that monetization and distribution are so tied. Even with advertising, I think we see that distribution is causing challenges to advertising, because in fact reach is there when a game like a Diner Dash can be played by 200 million people, but no one site controls a critical mass of that, and no one publisher controls. You know, I can't control everywhere Diner Dash is played, and then Yahoo can't control, you know, only but their little slice in each game. And so how do you have a cohesive experience with a large market? That's the challenge we have in casual gaming. But in terms of the applicability of advertising to gaming, there's nowhere it's better than with casual gaming. You have larger audiences. You have people who, you know, they haven't just paid $60 to take home a game. That game is not set in the future or has violent themes that brands don't want to associate themselves with. I mean, how many of P&G companies want to advertise next to a cop getting beaten or something like that in Grand Theft Auto,
is not going to have a lot of brand advertisers actually. So,
really? Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there's exceptions to every rule. I mean, you know, can you put in-game advertising into Halo after paying $60 for it and it's a futuristic game? Probably not. But can you have an interstitial commercial near a light casual game, session-based type of experience? I think it's the ideal format. It's an engaged form of media. It's a repeat form of media. It's one where we know the demographic, psychographic, and even geographic data on the user. We can offer them, we have their name and address. We can offer them to receive a direct mail piece as part of a promotion survey for
retention.
And
you can't TiVo and fast forward it.
You can't TiVo.
And it's an
easy fake address.
Yeah, and the other thing is you can place ads there that are of a standard IAB format. So there is a lot of talk about in-game advertising, especially in-game advertising in core games, but those generally, it's very customized. There's a long history and a lot of money that has changed hands for product placement in those kind of games. You know, the branded car, Coca-Cola, branded t-shirts, things like that. Consumer products companies pay to be placed in games just as they do in television. And now there's a lot of talk with the company Massive that was acquired by Microsoft of dynamically placing advertisements in those worlds. So as you drive around in Grand Theft Auto, that the billboards would be dynamically replaced with real advertisements. And the problem is that's theoretically appealing, but it's difficult for advertisers to spend lots and lots of money on that because it's a custom offering.
It's also a controlled platform, not like the PC, which is an open platform. I mean, Sony, although they promised, according to rumor, they're going to open up their in-game advertising, but it's not confirmed yet. And Microsoft, they only use Massive. So it's really a controlled environment,
right.
Harder to get in than compared to the PC platform.
So we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to open questions in the audience. There's one back here.
Well, Scrabulous is the number one game on Facebook, and that's heavily female.
It's also, I think, a matter of time. The API has been available for, what, 6 or 7 months, and there's not a lot of great gaming experiences on Facebook from the perspective of those of us who, like, have been developing real game experiences. I think the interesting things, a couple interesting things. One, Facebook is actually offering an opportunity to redefine what is a good gaming experience. So it's something that's probably not highly graphical, but it could be very, very interesting and engaging and completely new patterns of play because it's so inherently social in an asynchronous manner. And two, I think that as we look at the problems of distribution and fragmented distribution with the portals, distribution is really defined by where are people. Advertising is where are people that I can bring my message. Well, if people are now on social networks and not spending as much time on portals, then social networks by definition become a critical form of distribution for gaming, and gaming being one of the primary use cases of what people do on computers. I just think we're just seeing a tip of the iceberg and small experimentation. I can tell you everyone from PlayFirst to Electronic Arts are looking at social networks as very, very critical elements of their distribution strategy.
I think most of those won't work out very well, frankly. But
no, most of them will fail. Like 90% of those efforts will fail, right? But some will succeed.
Right, but it's from the point of view of the social networks, it's very important to add games. And you saw, I mean, you know, from the early days of Friendster, the first time they had, you know, a million people, it's like, oh, now, and because it didn't have a lot of utility the way Facebook did, what do we do with all those people? We need to keep them engaged with our sites. And gaming is very engaging and increases the session time at the site. And so many of those sites with lots of people want to add games because it's retentive, and then that's more time during which they can display advertising to you. Other questions? Here in the front.
Yeah.
So let me just repeat the question. So the question was, the gentleman has a destination site about gaming and wants to provide games to the audience. How do you do that?
Yeah. So I think as we were talking about that meta structure around the games, the information, we can make that available to you by an SDK, by an RSS feed or some sort of XML-based protocol where you can then just feed that into your community and then discuss it, blog about it, that sort of thing. Might be interesting.
Why don't you want to have the games on your site?
Mm-hmm. For editorial kind of integrity.
Great, thank you. I think we are getting the hook. Are we getting the hook? Yeah, it's time. So I want to thank my panelists for joining me here in Austin.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, Sharon.